we actually have to look at graphs. And so that will be the new section, which would be basically solving the Gauss constraints, which I hope to be finishing today. And tomorrow we can solve the flatness constraints. And if we manage that, we have actually solved 3D quantum gravity to some extent. It's your first quantum gravity theory, I guess. So what is a graph? You can provide very abstract definitions. What we need here is a bunch of edges, you know, and edges, again, they're just paths, so it's just embeddings of the interval into your spatial manifold. And once you are there, you have one edge, for instance, E1, and you can have a completely different edge, E2, here. They all come with orientations. They have little arrows. But of course, you can basically also start from another vertex here and have another edge here. So what I will use as a graph is basically a bunch of edges which only cuts through each other at the vertices. And for instance, this would be the source vertex of this edge, and this is a target or final vertex of this edge. We will need that later. And basically, we have now all these systems, all these little quantum systems. We have a Hilbert space associated to E1, Hilbert space HE3, and let's put E2 here. And we have also a Hilbert space associated to the second edge here. So we have these graphs, which in this case is a very simple graph with four vertices, three edges, and I will in general denote it by capital gamma. Graph has basically edges which are oriented and vertices. And you can define different classes of graphs, and we will just actually interested in very regular graphs in the sense that you don't have loops or several edges between vertices. So you can imagine all kinds of things, which in principle are allowed, but we are not so much interested in it here. And so you have these several edges in parallel, or you have several edges here, and to each edge you have a Hilbert space associated. So basically, the question is, what is a Hilbert space associated to gamma? And see, this gamma has n edges. And as is usual in quantum theory, if you have several systems which basically exist in parallel, you take the tensor product. Of these Hilbert spaces. So this means in theory, if you, for instance, if you take the tensor product of the Hilbert space associated to L2R and with, again, L2R, the Hilbert space which you get is functions on L2R2. So what you get here is now your space of functions lives on n copies of the group. And the inner product on this Hilbert space is given by, taking basically again kind of a tensor product inner product. You take this wave function. Take this one, and then here you take the product measure, and this defines you an inner product on the Hilbert space, and that is completely the same way which you would do if you would have taken the tensor product of, for instance, Hilbert spaces R dx. And if you take a tensor product of this space, that can be actually identified as a space of function of over R2 with dx dy measure. Okay, so we have basically now a Hilbert space associated to several edges. And let me stay here. That allows us to actually consider the action of the Gauss constraints. And if you remember how the Gauss constraints looked like, they're pretty complicated, was kind of a derivative of E plus plus the term which was connection and E. So if you would take this expression and try to directly quantize it, might have difficulties, but there's an easier argument, and that is that classically we know that the Gauss constraints generate rotation in the internal index. Or in other words, or gauge transformations, and we know how the holonomy actually transforms. So this generates gauge transformations, SU2 gauge transformations. In particular on our holonomy. So now it's just a question how, so the holonomy at some point, I use H and G for group elements, and sometimes G is a holonomy and sometimes H is a holonomy. So HE was mapped to somebody can remember. So I guess that was a starting vertex here. And apparently there's a minus one here. We take the inverse here. So this is H E. And this is the starting vertex, and this is the end vertex. And here this is a final vertex. So, and we take just the group element here. And the gauge trapho again means that you have one group element associated in principle, to every spatial point in your hypersurface. So that means if you are at a vertex, there's a group element sitting there, and the holonomy transforms with respect to these group elements. Okay, so if you have a wave function, of one edge, on a gauge transformation, we see that this happens. So it's again the same as what we have in R. If you translate your argument and you define this as a transformation, what happens is that the wave function gets translated in your argument. And sometimes it depends whether you put a minus one here and a plus one here, whether you basically put for the translation a plus or a minus. So that doesn't matter in the following because we will take anyway the average over everything. So this gauge transformation induce an action on wave functions so actually in principle I should take invert all these elements but I'm not going to do that and if you remember yesterday we spoke a lot about the left and the right action so this can be actually written as the left action And the left action was actually with the inverse, so I would have to take minus one. Wave function here. And the right, oops, sorry, not the right action. Also with a minus one. Apply to the wave function. And that is all evaluated at the solonomy. So all these exercises about left and right translations were actually useful in the end because we see that our Gauss constraints generates left and right translations on our wave functions. And this is for one edge. So putting edges together at vertices, we basically just get all these actions acting at the same time on our different edges. So this vertex, the final one, means that E is actually incoming. With respect to this vertex, you can see it comes into this vertex, and this is the source to, the source vertex, so E is outgoing with respect to the source vertex. So if you consider one vertex, you have a number of outgoing edges, and you have another number of incoming edges. Then we have an action of our gauge transformation at V. So now, okay, I can keep this. So I will use h for the arguments of the wave function. So say you have n edges here at this vertex. And then this is transformed into tensor product. So you have the left action with respect to g. G is basically the gauge parameter. And you have to apply it to each edge which is incoming. So where v is the final vertex for this edge. So this would be these ones. And so what I've done now is just put g minus 1 equal to g, which again doesn't matter. And the right action for every vertex, for every edge which is outgoing. And this acts on v. So if you want to put lots of brackets, you basically write that this acts on V, and then you evaluate this on all these arguments, h1 to hn. Okay. Now, you need to remember what we did, all these exercises for the parametrized particle. And I told you how to solve constraints. And we are going to do that. You know, I told you, solve constraints, you can write a delta function in front of your wave function. So we are going to do that. We write the delta function in front of our Gauss constraints. Then the question is, okay, we don't even know what is this Gauss constraint. What is the delta function of this Gauss constraint? But for the parametrized particle, I explained to you that we can write this delta function as an averaging over the transformations, which are reduced by this by the transformation. Is there a question? Yeah. So I can write g minus one indeed. So, but it doesn't really matter if you want. You can write g minus one. Because we take the average anyway. And if you want to write it as an action of your group and preserve the group structure, you have to take this g. If you don't care about that, you can write g minus 1. So it's a question of definition. We can do both. It does not matter because we take the integral over g. And the Haar measure, for instance, is invariant under the invariance. It only matters under inverting g. It only matters if you want to define the action of the gauge group as a representation. Then you have to take g, because only then you get this group multiplication law. Otherwise, you get something inverted. But it's only a question of taste. So. You know, so it doesn't matter. For what we are going to do, it doesn't matter. Yeah, here in theory, I mean, this is So I told you this transforms in this way, and then like a poor mathematician would already write this not with G but with G inverse. Yeah, so okay. So we do this thing which we discussed a lot for the parameterized particle. We write the delta function, and now the question is, what is this delta function of a constraint which I haven't even told you what this constraint is? And for the parameterized particle, we did the following. We wrote the delta function as an integral, which was basically as an integral over the gauge transformations. So H bar, probably I, H bar, S, DS. So we wrote it as an integral over the gauge transformations generated by this constraint. And I just told you that for one vertex, the Gauss constraint generates these gauge transformations. So we do the same. We just copy everything here. Copy this action of our Gauss constraints at V. So this would be the Gauss constraint at V. Left G times final source E R G, and not very surprisingly, we take the Haar measure here because the Haar measure is the Haar measure which is invariant under left and right translations, and we have to take here also basically a measure which is invariant under translations. And indeed, the so-called Lebesgue measure is invariant under translations. It's actually uniquely specified by this. And here it's also uniquely specified by being invariant under left and right translations. So this is actually basically the operator which will map us from any state to a state which will be gauge invariant at this vertex V. Okay, and what I'm doing here is I'm just taking the average over the gauge orbit and I have the only what I have to be careful is to take the right measure here. Because otherwise, I don't get anything which is invariant. But once I have something which is constant on this gauge orbit, it is basically gauge invariant just because I can move around and I get a constant. So for the parameterized particle, I told you a lot that it's important to define the physical inner product because if you're not careful, you get a divergence. Here it turns out the gauge orbits are compact because you take an integral over over the group G SU2, which is compact. That makes life much more easy. One of the main reasons why it's much easier to consider Euclidean quantum gravity, because for Lorentzian gravity you get non-compact groups. And that means that you don't really have to care about these physical inner product versus kinematical inner product, because the physical inner product will be the same as the kinematical inner product. And what it basically means is that this is really a projector in the sense if we square this funny operator, you know, which in this, if you think, you know, square delta x, you should never do that. But in this case, you get actually really properly mathematically well defined, just this back, and this is just the projector property for a projector P. P squared projecting twice gives you just P. So let's consider a three-valent vertex with three outgoing vertices, edges, a three-valent vertex with three outgoing edges, J1 to J3, and basically, you know, we had this picture of one edge, so if I'm not wrong, then the M indices where it's a target vertices, and here we have basically all the n indices, n1, n2, n3. So we consider this vertex, and we consider a spin network of this vertex. So we consider a state psi g1 of three group elements, which, you know, I can write in my Dirac notation as the bra with lots of g's evaluated on a cat, and the cats are supposed to be my basis states, my spin network basis states. So this again just means that I have just these normalization numbers, the dimensions, square root of the dimensions. And here I have my representation matrices or Wigner functions or whatever you want to call them. Yeah, so we consider this spin network function for the three valent vertex. And we want to apply our great technique to solve all the constraints in the universe onto this spin network function. And now you have to remember the action of left and right translations, or better, I have to remember the action of right translations. So for the outgoing edges, I only have this term with the right translations. So let me write it here. So I have the right translations for every edge, for every edge. So let me, now I'm sorry, so I promise you to use h, so let me use h for the arguments here. And this is, so PS3. So we have the right action with respect to g, and we apply it to psi, and we take the integral over dg, and we evaluate this with respect to h. And let me just put all these things which don't matter here. And then next we apply I'm again nearing the region where nobody can read anything. I apply what we figured out yesterday about how the right translation act on our matrix elements. So we write actually just G here and use the group multiplication law to get two G's. So what I get is H1 here. And the thing that you can't read, but I will put up the blackboard in 10 seconds. Now, so right translations act by putting G here. I use group multiplication law. I get one matrix for H and one for G. And I get that for all the three edges. And the result is that I have basically still these group elements evaluated at h, and these group elements, which are all at the same g, and I have to integrate over g, because that's what is written there upstairs. So what I need to know is what is the integral of three group elements, three matrix elements, evaluated at the same g, integrated over g. So this is an N, and this is also an N3. I hope I'm not. Yeah. And this is again a spin network function. And here I have to tell you what this is. And this is something which I will call, which is abbreviated in the following form. It's a certain number which depends on your indices, and it's two sets of numbers which are multiplied with each other, and these things are called three Wigner, three J symbol, or sometimes three JM symbol, and they come from recoupling theory. So I've provided some formulas in the script. They actually arise if you couple two angular momenta to one angular momentum, then modulo some signs and normalization, you get one of these symbols. Here, per edge, we have two angular momenta. That's why you get two of these. But they are just coupled with each other, which multiplied with each other, which basically reflects that one edge is the tensor product of two J representations. So if you have never seen that, just take that as a function of fixed numbers. And what you should know is that now if you contract these numbers with your spin network function, you get something which is invariant under rotations at V. So, and actually, you know, this factor is just a prefactor. And this is just basically a normalization factor, which we can drop, and we will drop it, because this spoils our normalization. And just the factor in front. Here, we take the sum, which comes from there. We still have, I put the d's into the state. So we have then our 3J symbol. And we have our state H E J E. P-E-N-E. Actually, this part turns out to be normalized to one and it is our gauge invariant spin network function. I abbreviate that for three valent vertex. And it turns out it's one. You can conclude that if you use this property that p squared is p and apply again delta g to this expression, you get again two three MJ symbols, or two three J symbols, and you need that these two of them contracted with each other are one to confirm this equation. So this is one because if you take the sum over all the lower entries, you get one. Hey, and that means actually you have solved the Gauss constraint. We will need later also vertices with you know, like two incoming and one outgoing. I think I will do that tomorrow, or tell you at the end of the lecture, because it's actually only some signs which you get. But it's basically the same thing. You get basically these three GM symbols. And maybe not in the exercise. So this is a three-valent vertex. And let me tell you that actually delta GV is an intertwiner. We had that already yesterday, I think. Because if something is gauge invariant at the vertex, it means it transforms under the trivial representation. So this delta GV actually intertwines between some certain sum of trivial representations in general anyway, the tensor product of all the angular momenta which meet at this vertex. And actually, intertwiner is not very well defined. Everyone uses this somehow differently. So you can also say that this, and you know, this is an intertwiner, and some denote that maybe this depends. I don't know. I don't think there's any big this iota m to m three, m one to m three, j one to j three. And this again just means what I've written here. If you contract three of your representation matrices, here, you know, from the right or actually from the left, with the symbol, you get something which transforms in the trivial representation. Okay. So I told you it comes from angular momentum coupling. And if you have seen that, angular momentum coupling works only if certain conditions are satisfied. And angular momentum, if you remember, it means that you take one spin, J1, you couple it to another spin, J2, and classically you want that this is equal to J3, and that works only if, for instance, the triangle inequalities are satisfied, because if J3 is much longer than the sum of J1 and J2, you don't get it. And indeed, you have basically the triangle inequalities need to hold. And we cannot write this in this way. It just actually means the triangle inequalities, if you put as length just J, and there's another condition which needs to hold, which is we couple to the spin zero representation. We couple three representations to the spin zero representation. And this is bosonic, as you might remember. So what we need is that the sum of the j's again gives us something bosonic, which means that g1 plus g2 plus g3 should be an entire number, or it should be a natural number and not a half number. And here you already see, so this is actually equivalent to J1 plus G2 bigger J3, J1 plus J3 bigger than G2, J1, J2 plus J3 bigger than G1. So these are the triangle inequalities. And of course, you might ask yourself, okay, where is the triangle? And you can already guess, because yesterday we discussed the length operator. And the length operator was not giving you the length of the edge, but the length of the dual edge. And to make it more precise, you know, let's actually quantize the Gauss constraint. And again, we don't take the classical expression, but having discussed how gauge transformations act, that these are generated by the gauge transformations are generated by the Gauss constraints classically. So, and we have seen that this is a right action here. So, if you want to have the Gauss constraint, we just take the infinitesimal version and we have the infinitesimal version of the right translation, where defined as left invariant vector fields. If you remember, how did we quantize the fluxes? As left invariant vector fields. So this is the last thing I'm going to say today. So the gauge trafos for vertexes outgoing edges were given by right translations. the infinitesimal version of this right invariant vector fields or the right invariant vector field. And this was actually the action of E or flux operator was actually defined as, oh, sorry, as left invariant. So this right translation, left invariant vector field. So this was defined by, I think, IH bar, left invariant vector field, K. This was our quantization of the fluxes. So this means actually, for this case, I can quantize the Gauss constraint, and this is given as flux associated to E1 plus flux associated to E2 plus flux associated to E3. And if you want, you can take components here. And it turns out that all the constants and whatever signs are chosen such that indeed even the constraint algebra is promoted into a quantum constraint algebra. That's just because the fluxes, you know, each flux satisfies the SE2 algebra and the fluxes at different edges commute with each other. So it's easy to see that you just get commutator between two Gauss constraints. V gives you just an epsilon ij k with another Gauss constraint. Mm-hmm. And this has to be zero. And that's why it's called a flux. And that's why also these constraints are called Gauss constraints, because the Gauss constraint tells you what comes in, comes out again. The flux of through a closed region without sources and things and whatever is zero. And then if you remember our discussion of this flux, it was given you the cotriate of the dual edge. And the dual edge was transversal to the holonomy edge. And it gives you, you know, the frame of this edge or the coordinates of this edge in a given frame. And in this case, we have all the same frame. So we define the fluxes always at the frame on the starting vertex. You know, that was all this adjoint action of transporting the fluxes around. So here we have actually a common frame. Frame means really in our internal internal J index. This is basically the dual edge where our flux was defined. And the flux gives me this dual edge in this frame. And then there was also something about positive orientation. So all these fluxes are oriented. And basically, this is EK. You know, this is basically the coordinates of this curve in the internal frame, the components of this. And you get a second interpretation of the Gauss constraint, because it means these three vectors give you a closed curve, or as this constraint is also called the closure constraint, it ensures you that the triangle is closed. It just means that you really come back to this vertex and don't end up here. So what we have with the three-valent vertex is that the three-valent vertex is dual to a triangle, and the Gauss constraints ensure that this triangle is actually a closed triangle and not some funny triangle. And if you take all of them outgoing, all live in the same frame, you can easily treat all the other cases. You just need to transport everything properly with holonomies. Okay, and modulo these other vertices, which we need tomorrow to build our tetrahedron, that solves the Gauss constraints. And we have triangles, and tomorrow we can actually try to solve the flatness constraint, and then we have a tetrahedron, and that is almost, I'm completely exaggerating, almost a complete 3D theory for a sphere. For the spherical case, which is a bit boring because it has zero dimension, 0 degrees of freedom, but this will give us basically complete understanding of this case. Okay, thank you.